Well, to round out today's show, I'm going to finish my conversation I started last week on our Labor Day episode with Marianne Garneau. Marianne is an organizer with the Industrial Workers of the World. She is the chair of the IWW's education department. She teaches labor studies in a New York university, and she also publishes the online journal organizing.work, which is a kind of primer of organizing experiences, lessons, and perspectives from workers. Last week, our conversation was about a lot of history and social ideas. This week, we want to talk a bit more about nuts and bolts organizing concerns and relate them to building the power we need to change the world. So let's talk about worker power. We're talking about legalistic versus material understandings of power.
This is where the whole like PRO-Act thing comes in. What a lot of like reformers in the labor movement want to do is make it legally easier to obtain recognition. But that's just formality.
Right. And there's this feeling that the state is the most powerful entity in the room, which is kind of ironic considering all of this radical posturing assumes and is frenetic to convince everybody else that we really have the power. But when it comes down to like actually trying to implement on that understanding, there's fear and doubt, and there's this sense that, well, we have to get the objective conditions right for that.
Look at the way business views the state or acts in relation to the state or in relation to law. Do they genuinely seem afraid of breaking the law? Take ULPs as an example, unfair labor practices. It's basically the legal remedy available to workers when they are organizing if the boss breaks the law. Employers don't give a flying whatever about unfair labor practices. They specifically violate the law all the time and do so intentionally because they know that the penalties are not that severe and they also don't really care. They're not fighting fair, they're fighting to win, you know? So yeah, the idea that the state is some neutral arbiter, which is the fiction that we have in our labor relations system, is a fiction. And yet people think that what we need to do, as you're saying, is tinker with the laws, tilt them a bit more in workers' favor, and then we'll be able to unleash a more powerful working class. That's not really the way that things work.
Yeah, in my own experience, in my own union, we are told that there are three types of power. There's legal power, there's relationship power in the sense of the relationship with the boss, and then there's worker power. And it's absolutely mind-boggling how they will lay out that sensible, useful three-part analysis of power and say that, you know, our power isn't in the law, it's not in our relationship with the boss, it's with the worker. But then here we are talking about how to get the best contract, how to appeal to the boss's sense of reasonability and asking for things they'll say yes to. And there's this just kind of disconnect around what we know.
Like, how did they describe relationship power?
I mean, just in the sense of being in the good graces of the boss, giving the boss what they want or compromising, doing things that maintain the relationship of the boss who is assumed to have the power, then dispensing that in the ways that we want.
Yeah. So behind that is some notion that if we maintain good relations, then we can get things from the employer, basically.
Right.
Yeah. Which is hilarious. I mean, any worker knows that that's not the case, right? It's not that your boss is always has their hair on fire and is always trying to punish you or something, but this fiction that you are somehow equals having some kind of rational exchange or debate is a fiction. If you want something that the employer doesn't want to give you, they just don't give it to you. They don't even give you a reason. It's not that good relationship is not actually leverage. It's also a fiction, right?
If we look at the situation of how the earth is heading for climate chaos, and the bosses knew about this for a long time, bosses will make decisions that are rationally against their interest if, in some sense, at least that they perceive, it means that they have power and control. We can't even talk about meeting them as rational equals because they rationalize according to their own power, not according to some objective shared interest.
I've always felt this was summarized really well by that comic. It looks like it was a New Yorker comic where there's people sitting around a campfire after the apocalypse, and there's a guy in like a tattered business suit, and he's saying, sure, we destroyed the world, but for a minute there, we delivered really great value for our shareholders. Like, that's basically the logic by which business decisions are made.
It's not just business. It happens in the public sector too, especially after 40 years of neoliberalism. Government and public service administrators trying to get things done cheaper, but which, you know, may actually mean worse service for the public, to say nothing of what the workers experience when they're sped up or understaffed. It's very tempting to want to engage our bosses like they're going to listen to us and understand, because our whole culture, American culture, is rooted in this idea of class collaboration or classlessness, and that we are all somehow equal, at least in the sense that we equally want things to work out for whomever it is we're theoretically serving. But the reality is, the bosses, whether they're private sector or public sector, make these decisions that, from the perspective of the rest of society, or the workers at least, are totally irrational.
I think one thing the pandemic has done is really accentuated or put into relief what is considered to have value. The services that are provided, people's well-being and happiness, don't actually have that much value in a capitalist society, right? We've seen how little value is actually placed on human life during the pandemic. We don't want services to completely break down, but we can stomach, millions of deaths. And this gets back to the politics thing, where how is it then that we imagine that there's some kind of exchange of ideas taking place in the political sphere, where if we get the right people elected who have the right ideas, or if we form the political party that has the right inspiration, that somehow we are going to, I don't know, get out of this mess. I mean, clearly what is taking place instead is a pretty naked power struggle. And on the one side, you have working people who value their own lives and value many other things like dignity, quality of life. On the other hand, you have a massive countervailing force that is basically trying to wring as much profit out of society as possible. The only way to really counter that is by developing the power of working people, the latent power we have, in that all of society depends on us. And that's the other thing that was really put into relief during the pandemic, with the notion of, for example, essential workers, the fact that society does not actually function or happen unless we have things like grocery store clerks. We don't particularly need, I don't know, investment bankers, but we need grocery store clerks when you strip right down to it, what we need in order to function. And yet, you know, it's like people get called heroes and at the same time get the same amount of kind of disrespect and discipline from their employer, even as we're realizing how essential they are, which is why it's never enough to rely on objective conditions to kind of win this battle for us. We really do need to organize to be able to deploy our power.
And just to kind of bring it back to the organizing perspective, when we're talking about organizing our power, it's very specific to what we are doing, because when we're talking about labor power, we are talking about the specificity of what we do and interrupting or controlling that. And I'm wanting to ask you to speak more to how important it is for workers to really understand what they're doing, what their work is, how it mechanically flows, in order to then make decisions about how best to take control of that in a way that causes the employer to do what we want.
I do think that one of the most important sources of leverage in workplace struggles comes from the regular flow of work. Actual work stoppages are obviously also extremely important, because generally speaking, work stoppages interrupt business, they interrupt the flow of profits, they interrupt what that entity is trying to do. But also taking a look at workflow and work processes can be a tremendous source of leverage in the workplace. I mean, this is not a new idea either. Slowdowns, work to rule, that kind of thing have been around as tactics for a very long time. Any way of sort of sabotaging the work process, that's been around for a long time. But I think that that's another kind of neglected source of worker power in most of the labor movement.
People want big picture advice, and really what you have to say, and what I think we all need to spend more time thinking about, is the nuts and bolts. There's a fear that without a big picture perspective, that we don't actually really know where we're going. And I think that there's a kind of faith involved in this, both involved in labor organizing and involved in trying to build a better world, where we don't get to start from the end point. We only get to start from where we are. And that process is uneven and is open to mistakes. And at the same time, there's really no way of moving forward except from starting where we are. I'm wondering if you can speak how workers need to start thinking differently about where we fit into the picture of our power in society, because we can talk about how the law doesn't work for us. And there are people out there who will say, well, if we all just stick our hands in our pockets and walk out, we don't have to deal with any of this. But there's a lot of room in between, which is where I think things actually are going to happen. They're going to happen because workers take the initiative in their own workplace to just solve their own problems. And they're not trying to solve the problems of the world. But out of that process, they become connected to what are social problems.
It's basically an issue of learning to develop your own political agency, right? Some people think that political agency is something you exercise at the ballot box. You and I see political agency somewhat differently. We think it has to do with being able to wield the leverage that we have. And if all of society tomorrow put their hands in their pockets and insisted on a more humane social and economic configuration, then we would have that. The question is, how do we get there? Well, you have to get people, not one individual at a time, but one sort of constituency at a time to be able to put their hands in their pockets. A very important constituency is workplaces. That's an area where you have an employer exercising power over a defined boundary of people. You need to get those people to be able to exercise their collective political agency by, you know, putting their hands in their pockets. How do you get people to be able to put their hands in their pockets? They have to develop relationships of trust with one another. That's why people strike. They don't strike because they are suddenly inspired by the notion of revolution or the notion of workers' rights or the idea of a raise. They strike because their coworkers strike. And in order to do that, you need to have workers talking to each other about what the problems are and what it is that they want to accomplish. And everything really kind of pushes against that. I mean, if you organize, you notice that the hardest thing to do is actually to get workers to talk to one another. I have a friend who's been organizing various groups of workers as they reach out for help. And he said to me that his back of the napkin, a rough calculation, is that if a group of workers actually gets to a point of forming what we call a committee, so just a sort of group of them talking and taking action, if they actually get to the point of forming a committee and taking action, they win like 80% of the time. The barrier is in actually getting to that point. I mean, I publish a website that is primarily dedicated to the nuts and bolts of organizing because I don't believe in licking your finger and sticking it in the air and seeing which way the wind is blowing and making big predictions and prognostications about what's going to happen or whether we are on an upswing of class power or so on and so forth. I believe in really kind of patiently explaining to people how to get from A to B and then from B to C, and demystifying that a bit and giving a little bit of instruction on that, because it is possible. And the barriers that we have to overcome sometimes are not what we think, right? The barriers we have to overcome is not electing the right blessed politicians. The barriers we have to overcome are us learning to view our grievances at work as significant and as changeable, and developing the act of solidarity with our coworkers to do something about that.
That reminds me about all summer, in addition to this contested narrative of a labor shortage, which is qualified in terms of there's no labor shortage, there's a wage shortage. There's been this trend of workers quitting their jobs en masse, often closing restaurants and other businesses. Well, these mass quittings are exciting, and there's a number of people who seem to view them like propaganda of the deed, these actions that show workers everywhere what we can do if we withhold our labor. But you take a different interpretation of these actions. What's going on here, and how can we relate what's going on there to the task of labor organizing?
Yeah, someone once pointed out to me that their workers do take direct action all the time, the most common form being just quitting. And that's true. The problem is that it doesn't really put you in a position of power. And so there was an example in New York recently where there is a small butcher chain where a huge number of workers quit simultaneously. And the dispute originally started with the employer taking down BLM and pride signs and flags from the business, just the kind of capricious random crap that employers do. No reason to take these things down, not harming the business, but again, they're in charge, so they can do stuff like that single-handedly. And they immediately face repercussions. And apparently a lot of their workforce is African-American, queer, you know, drawn from those communities and populations, presumably because they were paying lower than the prevailing wage for butchers for, you know, this skilled trade, basically. And so the employer screwed up, and the workforce's response was to quit en masse. And look, you can say that it was kind of a noble thing to do and a gutsy thing to do, and it was. However, the day after, you don't have any leverage anymore, right? If you don't work there anymore, then you don't have any leverage anymore, and those workers will all scatter and find different jobs and with an entirely different set of coworkers and be in basically the same position with respect to a new boss. And instead, what I wish we had was more of a practice and more of an education of how to take collective action without removing your own leverage, but in a sustained way within a workplace so that you can start to shift the power balance between yourself and your employer.
If you have the willingness to quit or to otherwise face the consequence of being fired, it seems like you might as well spend that on taking a risk trying to change things rather than just, you know, saying, I'm going to leave these problems and then they won't be problems anymore for me.
Like sometimes you'll get an organizing lead and a worker will be like, everybody's really fed up and I'm fed up and we're all at the point of quitting. We don't even care anymore. We'll do anything. And it's actually very difficult to get people who are in that position to take action, even though they seem to be willing to go all in and risk it all. I guess that shows yet again the ways in which we are conditioned in society to not take collective action, to not take action against our employers in a way that empowers ourselves, to not basically build capacity with our own coworkers that we can use as leverage. We're generally speaking conditioned not to do that.
It's a part and parcel, I think, of the individualism of American culture, where we think about how we're going to solve this for ourselves. And usually the most straightforward way to solve problems for ourselves is just extricate ourselves from them, because we are taught you can go get another job. We need to be able to think in terms of we have a problem and we need to do something about it. And that means sticking with it and grappling with whatever it's going to take to actually change that problem. And that's a really big problem in our culture, because it's not just that we don't have union education. It's that I think on a much deeper level, our understanding of agency and how we cause things to happen in society and in our lives is myopic and is trapped in this lens of the individual.
Well, and also we don't see working conditions as political. We don't see them as changeable. We don't see them as a result of the disproportionate power the boss has over us. We don't see them as things that could be otherwise. The one thing that we are kind of allowed to see as changeable is maybe wages and benefits, but we don't look much beyond that, even within the labor movement, at the deep working conditions, the pace of work, the control over work. You know, those things are eminently political, I think.